All right, everybody. So back on the podcast, fan favorite, Dr. Eric Helms. How we doing, man?
I'm better now that I get to talk to you, man. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing well, man. So we were just talking about the charity donation, and we're going to stick with the one that you had done the last few times you've been on. So if you could just briefly describe that.
Yeah, AFSP, that's the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It is a foundation, nonprofit in America that does its best to prevent suicides. So I've been connected with them since I did an AFSP walk way back in like 2010 or something like that. So I lost my father to suicide back, it's been 2009, so a long time ago. I can't do math, 14
years.
Oh,
wow, it isn't long ago.
Yeah, pretty wild. And I've done a number of different rounds of raising funds for them. We've done our mass sales. We have a rotating charity that we give a good proportion of our new signups for. So, and I did one on my own in 2019. So I think I've either through myself or mass, we've raised over like 30 grand for AFSP.
Wow.
And they're very highly rated. And they do a lot of good work. They have, you know, prevention hotlines, they have fundraisers, they have education. So they do probably some of the best work in this area, and they're one of the biggest organization. So I really appreciate your willingness to donate.
Yeah, that's great, man. And not, you know, go down a whole rabbit hole with it, but it really has been eye-opening in the last, I would say, 5 years for me, is seeing how much mental health is being talked about. Like, obviously we know it's a huge thing, but seeing how much more and more it comes out. And then to me, it was actually surprising as I got into my mid-20s, I would say, of how common it was among men. Like, it's kind of more commonly you see anxiety and depression in women. I forget the exact percentage, how much higher it is. And overall, it is higher, although suicide is higher in men. But even just like half of my friends have something in that area related. And I'm glad that it is at least more openly discussed these days.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that depression and anxiety are actually higher in women. I just think that it's easier because there's less stigma around it in women.
Sure.
Like if you read research in this area, you find that they present differently on average between the sexes, and they won't necessarily seek treatment at the same rates.
Sure.
So I think it should tell you something that the suicide rates are either higher or comparable between men and women. And sometimes it's more like the success rate, unfortunately, in men.
Right. Yeah.
That, like, do we really then think that depression rates are higher in women if suicide rates are higher in men? Maybe we're just not actually picking up on them all. So there's still a stigma. There's still difficulty around talking about it in men, probably more so than women. And I agree, it is a really good thing that it's becoming something that is highlighted and more people are aware of it and it's becoming destigmatized. I think that's a really important step forward, for sure.
For sure. Yep. And for everybody listening, we will have a link below for that. So, Doc, we were DMing a little bit about the woes of Cavs. And I've decided I'm not going to show mine on this because this is, we do have kids watching this episode. So, but we've talked about the struggles of it. And you are doing an experiment with this orthotic device, right? So we're going to get into a lot of Cav stubbornness here. So I guess maybe just first a little primer on what you're doing, and then I'll talk about some of the things I've been doing as well.
Yeah, man. So I literally just finished the experiment yesterday. So what we did was based upon the studies, for those who aren't familiar, by Warnicke and colleagues, who I think is a PhD student specifically investigating the effects of stretching on hypertrophy and strength in various avenues. There's actually been 7 papers published by Warnicke as a lead author on this topic. What their primary intervention is they're looking at putting people in an orthotic device or doing long duration, high intensity static stretching. So what the heck is that? Typically, the intervention they use is for an hour being in a boot that looks very similar to a plantar fasciitis stretching boot that basically puts you into a manually stretched passive dorsiflexion. So your toes going towards your ankle and then holding that, basically sitting in a chair with your knee straight, leg out in front of you at the same height as the chair you're on, stretching the calf. When you first get into the stretch, the participants are rating it as an 8 out of 10 stretch discomfort, with 10 being the maximum amount of discomfort they could tolerate. and then living there for an hour. And then looking over time at how that impacts morphological adaptations, as well as strength, as well as range of motion. And the really cool findings were that in recreationally trained people and athletes, not necessarily bodybuilders doing calf raises regularly, but I don't think it'd be unreasonable to expect that some of them probably do some calf training or jump around or things like that. So not completely untrained calves. 15% increase in the first study that was published in muscle thickness in the gastric nemius. And depending on the study you look at, between a like 10-ish to 20% increase in strength, depending on the measure used. They've looked at dynamic leg press, calf raise 1RMs, as well as isometric straight leg calf raise and bent leg calf raise, which is pretty interesting. And there's also a cross-education effect. Very, very small in increases in hypertrophy, actually, in the other leg, which are inconsistently observed and not always significant, but pretty consistently about half that increase in strength occurring in the opposite leg, even though it was not being trained nor being stretched. So, and this is in 6 weeks, which I think is pretty neat. Yeah. So that's the background, and that informed my interest in this because we reviewed it in Mass, and I was like, that's pretty sick. I want to try that. My calves haven't changed much in years, except for them shrinking when I get tired of them not changing and just being like, I'm only going to train 3 sets a week.
Yeah.
You know, if there's one body part that I have that I don't train like a dedicated bodybuilder, I'll be honest, it has at times been my calves, more so when I'm focused on strength. But when I'm in a bodybuilding phase, I do train them pretty hard. But anywho, so what we did, I'm not willing to only stretch one calf and, you know, look like the lady in the water guy, but for his calves, or even risk it. So what we did was we did 4 weeks of baseline testing to establish my minimal change and normal variation. So anytime you're doing what's called a case study or a study on one person where there's no comparative group and I'm not having my control leg as the control, you have to do something to establish some link between the intervention and the observed effect, or you're just kind of observing holistically all that happened, which is not useless, but it's not as useful as being able to provide some type of connection to the intervention. There's a lot of limitations around a case study, but it's also pretty cool because you can take a lot more measurements. So what we did, 4 weeks in a row, I came into our lab and we did a bunch of different ultrasound sites, measures of muscle thickness, looking at the whole tricep serrae, the whole calf complex, both the soleus and the gastroc, measuring thickness, also looking at pination angle, which is just the orientation of the fibers in the muscle, which tells you some things about adaptations potentially. Mostly, I'll be honest, I'm interested in the thickness changes. We also did isometric calf strength. So we used a strain gauge, which is just a device that has a chain on either end. And when you pull on them, it measures the force in newtons that is the strain being produced, quote unquote. Rigged that up to a like a dip belt so I could do an isometric calf raise standing on the plate that the other end of the chain is attached to. So strength, muscle thickness, and pination angle. And then we're also looking at increases in mobility. So we're doing what's called a knee to wall test, which is pretty cool. It looks kind of like your front leg is lunging and you keep a rubber band under your heel. You stand on a, it's very low tech. It's pretty cool. You stand on a tape measure and then you see how far away from a wall in front of your leg you can be and still touch your knee to it without your rubber band popping out. And it gives you, again, it's not like standardized against other people. So you kind of have to look at the individual change because limb lengths will impact, you know, what your score will be. But anyway, looking at how my knee to wall changes over time. So we did 4 weeks of ultrasound baseline testing. That's our primary measure. And we just wanted to see what was my normal variation. So that's going to collapse the ultrasound user's ability to have variation. So it's going to have my normal day-to-day biological variation, or week-to-week, we should say, and any potential change that I was experiencing before I was stretching, just doing 20 sets of calves. Which was what I had been doing for a little bit. So that was so if we saw more than a whatever variation we saw in those 4 weeks, we can call that like a real change. We haven't analyzed the ultrasound data yet. So I think there's still I'm not going to be able to report the findings yet on this podcast, unfortunately, but we did those 4 weeks. But I can plant the seed and make people very excited. And then at that fourth week measurement was our pretest. And then 6 weeks in, we did our mid-test. And then another 6 weeks later, we did our post-test. And then we waited a week, stopped stretching, and did a post-post-test. So in total, this is a 17-week study, which is just how long they measured me for. And what I actually did for the 12 weeks was stretching each calf for 1 hour, 6 days per week. So I gave myself one off day and kept my 20 set per week training volume on calves, same modalities, just to see how they changed. And
were you weaker?
Data that I say again?
Were you weaker given that you were stretching so much? Like I imagine, well, you probably stretched after your workout, right?
Yeah. So generally I would, for like the first 6 weeks or so, I stretched at night so that it wouldn't, you know, potentially negatively impact my training, because I thought it would based upon the data we have. But eventually just I started doing it probably 80% of the time at night and maybe 20% of the time in the morning while I was on a podcast. So I would sometimes train 1 hour to 3 hours after the calf stretching, and I didn't actually notice a decrease in performance. It was still pretty strong. That might be because I did 7 weeks in a row, so I'd adapted to it. But the cool thing, so some of the things I can just tell you straight up, the data we do have, is we have, the strength measurements. So my isometric calf strength, how that changed over time, and also my range of motion. And those things went up pretty substantially. So I put about 300 newtons on my isometric calf strength, which doesn't mean a whole lot to people, but it was basically a 15% increase in calf isometric strength.
Okay.
Is that right? Yeah, it's like 2,000 at baseline. Yes, that's 15%. Math is hard. And my flexibility went up by 3 centimeters, which is a fair bit on the knee to wall test, and I totally noticed that change.
Yeah.
Leg press, I was getting deeper. Squats, I was getting deeper. At home, I have sometimes I do a single leg press calf raise, and there's a part of the sled that my heel could theoretically contact. It never did before, but now at the bottom of those calf raises, my heel actually touches that sometimes. I also think my hamstrings got more flexible because I was, you know, the position you're in to stretch the calf is basically like a sort of like a sit and reach test, but you're not sitting and reaching forward. So I've started to accidentally, occasionally touch the plate to the ground on RDLs. And I don't, like, I have good RDL form. I'm not actually letting my knees track forward, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I've definitely noticed increases in range of motion. My strength has gone up. And visually, it seems like my calves are bigger. The circumference measurements, we didn't get enough baseline tests to really have like an idea of like the variability.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to have two different people measure them because one was away during the, because we didn't start this at the ideal time. So one of my circumference measurements was done like right during the holidays, and it wasn't done by the same person. So it's possible my circumference went up, but it's also within like the between rater variability we have.
So how much was it? Can you say?
Yeah. So it may be around a like 0.6 centimeter increase in circumference. So it's not huge, but it's not nothing.
Yeah. So a few things.
That's within the error measurement. So I'm not sure.
Sure. I'm thinking like when the pandemic happened and like everybody's on Zoom and it's like, there's a joke, like, are you wearing pants right now? Cause it's all level up. And I'm just thinking like, Eric, are you stretching your calves right now? Like, is that on mute?
You're never going to know.
So, am I at all responsible for getting these circumference measurements? Cause I remember DMing you and being like, please tell me you took some actual tape measure measurements. And you're like, well, I wasn't going to, but I think you took one or something.
So you are, and it sort of worked out. So I happen to have gotten ISAC, ISAK stands for the International Society of Sports Kinanthropometrists. I don't know how the A and the K fit in there. I always have to look at it, but that's what it stands for. And we do a regular certification, and this is basically standardized, high level, high reliability skin fold and tape measurements of people. So you have to go through a course and you have to establish a very low variability in your measurements. So you have to do like 20 different profiles. So one of my students who's on this paper, that this case study is becoming, his name's Kai Homer. He's doing research on bodybuilding. Great guy. And him and Dr. Alyssa Joy Spence were kind of collaborating on this case study. Kai became an ISAC certified kin anthropometrist. And I was one of his profiles. And it just happened to land like 9 days before our pretest. So when you messaged me,
yeah,
I was like, well, I mean, I've been training 20 sets of calves. So we'll put in the manuscript so it's transparent. So it's not exactly the same day.
Sure.
So it was like 9 days prior circumference measurement. And then we, after you messaged me, we did a pre-circumference, a mid-circumference, and a post, and a post-post circumference.
Yeah.
But we didn't get the variability. That's the one downside. And when we look at those numbers, when it's a different operator, there's a large difference that I don't think is real. So the circumference measurements, we've included them, but I don't think they are very helpful.
And I just want to make sure I was mentioned by name in the paper. So
absolutely. We'll have an acknowledgement, Dave McConey, for suggesting to do circumference measurement. I think for people to kind of like, because you had made a good point, like, I don't know what this means to have an X percentage or an X increase in, you know, on muscle thickness. I think the percentage increase should keep people kind of relative idea of change. Yeah. So the percentage increase in muscle thickness, that'll be the most precise measurement. That's the one that we have the kind of minimal real change data on for the 4 week period. And it'll be an interesting case study. I mean, I do want to caution people that case studies are highly limited. And just because it's Eric Helms talking about it on the internet doesn't make this study any less limited than any other case study that's out there.
Right.
I will jokingly call this the Brad Schoenfeld effect. It's not his fault. It's not a bad thing. It's just that he's probably one of the most popular researchers online in the hypertrophy area. But when you talk to your typical science interested person on the internet and you ask them about, hey, like, are you aware of the research on high loads versus low loads? They'll cite like two papers by Brad Schoenfeld and not know about the other 10 that were done.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have a view of the literature based upon those popularized studies.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're misrepresentative studies that are bad studies. They're well conducted. And I'm really glad that, you know, Brad does the work he does. But for someone to have a real actual picture of the true landscape of literature on a topic, they really need to read not just, you know, 15% of the papers, right?
Sure.
So I think if someone like our case study should only move the needle a little bit on how people perceive the impact of stretching,
right,
on hypertrophy, it basically just tells us what does or does not work for Eric Helms and the magnitude, you know?
Yeah.
But it also gives us potentially some insights into whether or not this is a redundant or complementary intervention considering resistance training.
That's what I was going to mention. Yeah. Because that's one of my issues with, and just side note, you're killing me that you didn't do the unilateral, man, that you were, because I'm 3 years into this unilateral experiment. We need the dedication. So,
hey man, if I wasn't competing this year, I would consider it, but I am ultimately more of a bodybuilder than a scientist.
So yeah, because I've said this since like the BFR research from years ago, and I could be wrong. I haven't obviously looked at every paper, but to me, it's like, we compared this to that, and it's like, I could be wrong. I have not seen a paper where it's like lifting versus lifting plus BFR or like volume equated, and then same thing with the stretching. It's like, I fully believe that, at least from all the data I've seen, that stretching can induce hypertrophy, but can we see it compared to somebody doing an actual weightlifting routine? So while I certainly understand the end of one experiment on Eric Helms doesn't drastically change the literature, you were doing 20 sets and you're an advanced bodybuilder. I mean, that's pretty legit.
Yeah, I think there's value in that. And I pushed for doing the post-post test, which I think is really interesting. So what that is that after the 12 weeks of stretching and doing 20 sets of calves, I went down to doing 12 sets of calves and not stretching, but still purposely training using a full range of motion, pausing at the bottom and a high, you know, high RPE or close to failure. Mm-hmm. So still doing 12 hard sets of calves in a week with a full range of motion. And depending on what the ultrasound data shows us, this will tell us a couple things. One, do you need to keep stretching after you've got, well, hopefully I got some stretching induced, you know, gains in calf size to maintain those adaptations, or is full range of motion resistance training sufficient? And then if the answer is no, we don't have great data because it's a case study. We don't know if it's going to drop from 20 to 12 sets. So I'd be really surprised if for 1 week, 12 sets wasn't enough to maintain the fitness you gained from 20 sets. So we'd have some inkling of idea of whether these are differential stimuli, or at least for a week's time, and whether it is sufficient to maintain it. And of course, there's confounding factors. Is there edema and inflammation from, you know, doing stretching and then dropping it that that drop could be from? So it should be a lively discussion in the paper, even if it doesn't give us really, really firm answers. And this is one of those reasons why I think it's really important if someone is curious on something, they need to dig into the research on it. Because so, for example, most people are aware of the first study that Warnke published, 6 weeks stretching one calf, not the other. What they might not know, though, is that there's actually 7 papers that Warnke has done like in the last year. And actually giving us some hints as to whether or not we think this would be complementary or potentially redundant or the same as traditional resistance training with a full range of motion. So there was one published just a month ago today in Frontiers in Physiology titled Sex Differences in Stretch-Induced Hypertrophy, Maximal Strength, and Flexibility Gains. And they replicated the first study on men, and they did it on men and women. And here's what's really interesting, is that the men got significantly greater hypertrophy by a lot more. We're talking medial head of the gastroc, they had a 15% increase, and the women had like a 5% increase, and also more strength. And when you look at the research on sex differences in resistance training, there aren't any on average. You see similar relative increases in strength and hypertrophy following resistance training in men and women. So if there's sex differences in stretching, that could be indicative that these are not exactly the same stimulus. That doesn't mean I know that they're complementary, and there's more work to be done here. Like, is this a sex difference, or is this a sex difference per se, and it's just that less flexible people gain more or able to get a higher amount of tension out of stretching than more flexible people who have a more compliant muscle tendon unit. So I'd love to see a follow-up study in women and like rank ordering them by baseline flexibility. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. It's like, you know, it's always nice when you get a validation that like you're reading something and an idea comes, like, I think it's because of this. And then it's discussed. Cause I thought that was like, why would there be a sex difference? And I'm like, well, women are more flexible, so there's probably less of a stretch. And then I know that was discussed. So
for sure. It's probably less of a stretch. I like that. That's a double entendre. So that's one paper that I thought that kind of gives hints that perhaps this could be a complementary stimuli. And there was two others. So they also, like, some people might be wondering why an hour per day. Well, like a good researcher, they actually did experiment with 1 hour versus 2 hours, which F me, bro. Like, I don't know if I can hang with 2 hours. 1 hour per leg was 2 hours. Imagine me spending 4 hours per day stretching my calf. I would have
to. Oh, you didn't have two devices?
No. And like, I was halfway through and I was like, I should probably get it. And I was like, that's only another 6 weeks. And then every week that went on, I just didn't do it. So my laziness made me have to work harder.
I got to ask about the pain, because you know, the 1 to 10 scale is obviously so subjective, and like a week doesn't go by that I don't have a patient sitting in my chair very calmly telling me that they have like a 9 out of 10 pain. And I'm like, it's just, it's not possible that you are sitting here calmly with a 9 out of 10, but it's also almost arbitrary, because if we think of like a true 10 out of 10, like you're on fire and your limbs are being cut off, then everybody's at like a 4 or below, right? Even extreme pain. So I guess it's 10 relative to what lifting related pain could be, essentially.
Well, the way, if you read the papers, the way they induced it in the same way that we modeled, how I rate it myself, is that if 10 out of 10 is the most discomfort you can tolerate while stretching, you're going to an 8 out of 10. So it's not pain per se, although it is painful. And pain factors into it, but it's like stretch discomfort. So a 10 out of 10, you could sustain it. I don't know if I could for an hour, but when you initially set the device, the goal is to get to an 8 out of 10 discomfort. And the interesting thing is it changes. So within 3 to 5 minutes, in my experience, that lessens to about a 6 or 7, as there's some compliance that seems to occur, or you just tolerate and get used to the discomfort. And then it starts to get worse. So something they noted, and I was glad to see that I wasn't the only person to experience this. There's a section in the discussion of the paper where they compared 1 hour versus 2 hours. And I'll just quote them right here. Because participants in our investigation reported initial numbness after approximately 10 to 15 minutes, blood hypoxia combined with a mechanical stretch stimulus could be hypothesized to be the underlying mechanism for adaptations. So that is exactly what happens, is around 10 to 15 minutes in, I start getting like tingling sensations, and it starts to get that painful pins and needles, and it starts to hurt again, as bad or worse than it started. And then you have another, 45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not fun. It's completely infeasible. I don't think most people are like, oh, I like to stretch. This is not fun. I don't think this is like, this isn't a cheat or a hack. It's harder than just doing regular calf training. But that's also another possibility of why it could potentially be a differential stimulus to training, So it is a tension stimulus, but at the same time, we know that when you stretch a muscle, it compresses the microvasculature and you are creating a more hypoxic environment. And I don't think even with BFR, you could replicate that because it's an hour long, right? BFR, even if you're resting, say, a minute between sets and you do four, we're talking 6 minutes, including the time to do the first 40 rep set and 15 rep sets after that. So if it takes 10 to 15 minutes, if the sensation actually matches to the, degree that oxygen's available, you're looking at a 45 minute hypoxic environment while you're putting a muscle on tension induced stress.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's actually the mechanism. We don't have good mechanistic data looking at this, but I think it might be something that could. I think there's reason for optimism as to why it could be complementary or at least different to resistance training as a stimulus.
Were you able to
go ahead?
Like one of my issues with calf stretching is I'm always slipping, whether I'm standing on a stair or it's a leg press. Mm-hmm. Like it's always slipping on the shoe, and I'll do a 60 second stretch, and I probably have to reset one or two times. Were you able to get this device tightened where you're really able to just chill there and not like basically passively just sitting there and letting it do an 8 out of 10 stretch the whole time?
Yes. Yeah. And if you read the papers by Warnke, they specifically indicate that it's an 8 out of 10 at the start. And if it goes down from that later, that's fine. They didn't adjust it. Mm. But at the start of the next day, when you do an hour, you get back to an 8 out of 10. And so that creates this progressive overload. It's kind of like as your loads go up when you're training at an 8 RPE, you just allow them to go up, but you keep trying to hit an 8 RPE. So it's kind of like progressive overload.
Yeah.
And one of the things they measured, so they did two different measurements of flexibility. They did not only the knee to wall test like we're doing, but also their orthotic device is a legit orthotic device that they actually custom made. Mine was a plantar fasciitis stretching device that looks very similar, that has Velcro, that I got on Amazon for $25. And then once I was able to get too much flexibility and the Velcro would not overlap, I put paper clips. And then once I got so much the paper clips weren't enough to hold it in place, I pushed pins through the side. So I definitely jerry-rigged it. But their orthotic device, you can actually see the degrees. It basically has like a gonadometer on the side of it. So they measured basically what's the position we can get you into acutely at the start and the end of the study on the stretching device, and that increased substantially. So you can see that the individuals in the study are going tighter and tighter and tighter and getting into more and more dorsiflexion using the device over time.
Yeah.
And I think, just to kind of go back to, you were mentioning, like, you've got patients who, if we could have a magic device that read the subjective experiences of all people and then compared them against the objective average of true pain, which I don't even think is a real thing. Mm-hmm. They're actually at a 4 out of 10 when they think they're at a 10 out of 10. Even if that is true for the stretch discomfort, the amount of stretch they had, whatever perception they had, was sufficient to induce a 15% increase in hypertrophy.
Right, which is what's relevant. So,
right. So, it's possible that if I don't see, adaptations, maybe I'm easily discomforted, maybe.
Yeah.
That doesn't track with my life experience.
Mm-hmm.
I remember learning that I was doing BFR wrong, because like I was asking people also, like, you know, when your arms go, you know, they start to go tingly and blue, and they're like, that's too tight. What are you doing, Eric? I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, I'm just making it as tight as I can in training. Like, you know, and like, can you even feel your hands? Like, no, I can't. But so I have typically been someone who pushes it too far. Like, I've hurt myself in training, not been someone who holds himself back too much.
There's a specific story of you. So I've had certain things where that would, I guess, you know, quote unquote, prove my dedication to the gains, sure, that I wouldn't even mention on a podcast, but I could tell you afterwards. But you're the only person I've heard a story from where I'm like, oh, that definitely matches, where I think you said that you had a protein shake and you, yep, threw it up and then you forced it back down. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably on par with some of the stuff I've done. So, and I believe,
yeah, I've done silly things. I think that is a true story. I don't think we should get into it because it's gross. But I wouldn't do it again. But I understand the mindset I was in at the time. It was, you know, you flip a switch and it's like,
yep,
I'm doing a protein shake. I'm not wasting this. Yeah, I think another one on the training side, just to kind of, because it was my very first like training session when I decided I'm going to do bodybuilding. My buddy took me in. He taught me how to do deadlifts. I was probably doing them terribly, and it was just with 135, and I did three sets of 10, and on the last set of 10, I threw out my back. First time I ever trained for bodybuilding, and I went outside and I threw up, and I remember being like, this is fucking great.
Yeah.
Like, and then I started training 6 days a week from that point on. I didn't take any time off from hurting my back. I just trained around it, and that was just kind of the mentality I had. And I trained past failure for a good 80% of my training with forced reps for a long time early in my career. So I think I probably instituted a sufficient discomfort. The actual stretch on the calf, I don't know. You know, like, that's the interesting thing with the sex differences study, is that, you know, the more flexible people, the women, instituted the same 8 out of 10 subjective stretch and didn't grow as much. So I think it does depend somewhat upon not just the sensation of stretch, but actually how much tension is being applied, which could be impacted by factors that might not modify the pain experience, but perhaps do modify where the stretch is occurring. You know, muscle tendon unit covers a lot of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
If you've got, I don't know, adaptations to tighten the tendon, more sarcomeres in series, and you just have a more compliant muscle tendon unit, you might experience a ton of stretch, but you're not actually putting the muscle itself or the individual sarcomeres, you know, on stretch. I don't actually understand the specific physiology. I'm not sure anyone does yet.
Yeah. Well, that's actually something that I didn't think about until you just said it, but thinking about how women had a lower response, you know, I wonder how much of this would just lead to acute gains. But then once somebody's flexibility gets to a certain amount, they've kind of maxed out the amount that they could get from stretching.
I think that's very possible. I will point out that the women didn't get no gains. They did have significant pre to post improvement. So it was around 5%, which is not nothing in 6 weeks. But it was just like a lot less than the large gains that the dudes got, you know?
Yeah. Like, so it might be that, you know, if you start with a 12-inch cab and you have this potential of a 17-inch cab, like at some point you can pull out the trick of an extra half an inch from stretching, but then once you're super flexible, maybe there's just not much more there.
I think that's certainly possible. And it may be one of those things. This is an option, and your less flexible muscles is something you can get a little more out of, and then you don't necessarily get more out of it. I don't know. The mechanisms are yet to be elucidated, but there is, like I said, a reason for optimism. And there's actually one other paper that Warnicke did, and I'm assuming this is going to, I think it was all part of a PhD, because like there's seven papers on the same topic. He's the lead author, so it looks like a PhD by publication, which is more common in Europe as well as you know, Australasia and the UK and things like that. You typically start with like a research review, and then you go into some mechanistic work, or at least methodological work, I should say. And then you do some comparative studies, acute and then long term. And that's exactly, if you look at the spread of the studies, one of the, what I think was probably done earlier, but wasn't published until a bit later, just depending on how long peer review takes, was a meta-analysis that Warnke did. And if you read the methods, they attempted to do a meta-analysis on all of the long-lasting stretching studies in humans. There aren't any. Mm-hmm. So what it became was a long-lasting stretching-induced muscle hypertrophy in animal studies. So it has a lot of the, you know, studied by Antonio on quails and like the weighted wing hypertrophy-inducing stuff.
Yep.
And I think there's two or three main points I want to make on that. Is one, they looked at not only muscle and fiber cross-sectional area, but also fiber number.
Right.
So hyperplasia, right? Which is something that is controversial in humans because we can't methodologically confirm that that actually has occurred because you have to like kind of cut it open and count fibers and stuff to a greater degree than is typically ethical. A lot with animal models, you sacrifice the animal at the end and can actually count fibers. So the second point is they were looking at these things, and to say these were large effects is statistically true, because a standardized difference of 0.8 or higher is large, but it drastically undersells the actual changes. We're talking like 4, 8, and 9 as the effects. So they're like 5 to 10 times a large effect size.
Right.
So, and that's increases in fiber number as well as fiber and muscle cross-sectional area. So they're huge changes.
Right.
Granted, this would be the equivalent of putting yourself in the calf boot past what you think your maximal discomfort is because you're being tortured by researchers and you're an animal, and then staying there for weeks, an hour. So I think for one, it kind of tells you there's probably some crazy dose response here that is more or less linear. I think two, it tells you that it might be inducing hyperplasia, which may not be possible with traditional resistance training to any large degree. And they actually quoted an author in their meta-analysis, I've got it here, by McDougall. One possible explanation is that hyperplasia occurs only in response to a significant stretch overload that also causes muscle lengthening, and that conventional resistance training does not impose such a stimulus. So that's entirely speculative. And that was, I think McDougall wrote that in the 90s, if I recall correctly. But it's possibly true. So I think, unlike BFR, which I think, depending upon your stance on the role of metabolic stress and whether or not we really think metabolic stress is that much higher with BFR than traditional training, which is not as clear cut as it might seem. Like BFR, there's a world where we look at what's the actual mechanism for BFR, and we go, actually, the autocrine and paracrine, interactions locally, they're not doing much. What it is doing is creating early fatigue, and with low loads, you're able to, tap into high threshold motor units, and it's producing hypertrophy. It's possible it's not just that, but I would say there's a non-negligible chance that BFR is not actually different than traditional resistance training, and it is just kind of like a trick to get to, effective reps, if you will, earlier. But I would say I have more optimism, and I think it's more plausible that stretching might actually be a unique stress than BFR. I don't have data to back that up, and that's probably why I'm optimistic, because I think there are BFR interventions where you don't see a difference, even when it's added to traditional training.
Yeah, well, I can definitely understand the logic there. I was going to ask about with BFR, because it's almost, when I hear people talk about it, there's almost this assumption like, yeah, it's not any better. It's just different, if there's injuries and whatnot. Are there papers showing that BFR added to traditional weight training did not provide a benefit?
I have not. There are papers where they have added BFR to traditional training. There are not many, and there's not enough for me to, I can't recall them off the top of my head, which they are. And this isn't something that I've, looked over in preparation for the podcast. So don't take my word as gospel. But to my memory, my best of recollection, there are a handful of papers, maybe a handful, even overselling it. There's a couple papers that have done BFR plus resistance training, and they haven't found any advantage over just traditional resistance training.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's tons of, as Pac would say, terms and conditions that apply to those, papers and their limitations. But, there is, to be fair, there is also one paper where they took powerlifters and they had them train front squats with BFR and compared them to powerlifters who were just doing normal front squats and back squats. And they not only grew more than the group that wasn't doing it, but they also got a significant increase in type 1 fiber hypertrophy. And that was a group in, I believe, Norway that showed that. And it was with a really low dose of BFR training intermittently.
And these were already experienced powerlifters?
Yes. Yeah. Competitive powerlifters, I believe, is the national team. So that to me is like, whoa, you know, it's one of the only instances we have from a, you know, a lab group that I think that the data makes sense and I understand it, because there are some Russian papers, but they're kind of impenetrable to some degree, where we've observed not only, where we've observed type 1 specific hypertrophy in response to any resistance training stimulus, which is interesting. But it does make you wonder, is this something that's a product of the fact that they were powerlifters, had never done BFR before, and this might just be this kind of one-time deal? Would we have seen that in bodybuilders who do a training across a broader rep range? I don't know. But
right. It's always so frustrating when you look at, like, as a quote-unquote bodybuilder, when obviously it's not like every study is going to be tailored to what you want, but there's so many times where it's just like, yeah, but this could be explained by this. And if you were just doing bodybuilding training, maybe that wouldn't have happened. And it's true. Like, yeah, you can't just customize every study to how you want it, but it's frustrating from the outside. Cause, like, you know, I get a single study where bodybuilders just did this and answered the question, you know?
Yeah. And even if you had that single study, you wouldn't want to bet the farm on the single study, cause we would make a couple different replications. So yeah, the, ultimately, I would say that there is anyone who is kind of closing the door on BFR being a unique stimulus, this is a bit of a tangent, is being premature, or anyone overselling BFR is being a bit premature. There is reason to be skeptical and optimistic, and we are not even there yet for stretching, right?
Right.
The stretching stuff is really interesting. I'd be very surprised if it ended up doing nothing in trained humans, because the huge effects in animal models, and just as a reminder, again, all the studies on Wernicke are not untrained individuals. They're not necessarily bodybuilders doing calf raises every day, but they are recreationally active people who train, and athletes in most cases. So, yeah.
Just regarding injury risk, because I had mentioned that I always had the issue with the calf stretching kind of like slipping. And actually only recently had I kind of come across on my step, I will allow myself to slip so that I'm stable against the floor. And then I'll kind of do like a RDL, and I'll just kind of go down and down and really get like an intense stretch, to the point that I don't want to say I hadn't experienced that, but I hadn't been able to stabilize that intense of a stretch for a full 1 or 2 minutes. And there are times where I'm like, this, like, I wouldn't be surprised if I tore something right now. Like, I wouldn't be shocked. So obviously you didn't over this period of time, but did it ever feel like this is maybe getting a little bit iffy?
Early on it did. Yeah. And it was, I was nervous about training more than the stretching itself, because the stretching, the increase in my range of motion acutely was pretty substantial. And then I'm like, okay, I'm at a new end range of motion, and now I'm going to go do like a heavy set of like 4x6 on calf raise on the leg press. Like,
yeah,
that's safe. And yeah, I didn't injure myself in the 12 weeks, which is great, but I was concerned. Like, this isn't like a graded dose response. You know, like, as a physical therapist, this isn't what you'd be like, you know, let's add to your 20 sets, 6 hours per week of stretching on calves. Like, I did a video on this for Mass most recently, and I said, look, if you want to try this, start with 10 minutes on your off days, because 10 minutes is a long stretch. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason we need to go with this hour long stretching intervention just because it was effective in the literature. And there is actually a study where they did just 10 minutes a day during COVID in athletes. And Wernicke actually observed, they didn't measure hypertrophy for this one. Not all their studies look at that, but there's an article using daily stretching to counteract performance decreases as a result of reduced physical activity. And they used a calf board, which is just something you can tighten and increase the angle. So kind of like stretching it on a stair. And they just stretched one calf for 10 minutes per day at an 8 out of 10 discomfort on the calf board. And they had a 10% increase in strength and like a 3% increase in their single leg jump height. So not only did it counteract these athletes' decrement in performance from not being able to do conditioning training for their sport, it actually increased performance. And the control group saw a decrease. So the control group that was not doing anything and couldn't go to the gym and was stuck in their home during this COVID lockdown, they got poorer at jumping on a single leg and they got weaker in their calves. And I would have considered this a successful intervention if they just, the group that was stretching just stayed at baseline.
Right.
But they didn't. Their strength went up 10% and their jump height went up like 3.2%. So
yeah,
pretty
yeah,
wild.
For sure.
And just 10 minutes a day. So not an hour.
Six days a week or every day? Seven. Okay.
Yeah.
So for reference, what was your starting circumference?
Right around 40.5 centimeters.
Okay. What is that like?
I'll convert to inches because American. All right. So that is 16 inches.
16 inches. Okay. Pretty much right there. And then your arms are what? Like maybe 17?
Are we getting my Steve Reeves numbers in there?
Yeah,
so I have 17 inch arms in the off season, and they get down to when I'm leaner, like an inch less than that, or something.
Yeah, yeah. And you're a little over 200.
I'm 210 right now.
210. Okay.
And I compete at like 180, just to put that.
Right.
So you can understand how high my body fat is right now.
Sure. Sure. So this will be a video I'm sure I will reference to many other people for like the calf journey. So I'm going to take just a few minutes to just kind of go over things I have tried over time.
Which I think you have more experimental coolness behind what you've done for your calves than I do.
So when I started, I was about taking measurements. I was 14. I was 130 pounds at the time, 5'11". I'm now 6'1". So I started with, I want to say 12 inch calves and 11 inch arms. The biggest my arms have gotten soft, 17 and a half inches in the off season, no pump, but flexed. And then the biggest my calves ever got was 15 inches. And that was pretty much in high school where they've more or less been ever since. And when I was in high school, do you remember Chad Waterbury from like Teenage?
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. So he was all about high frequency training. So, it was the first couple of years, I'm like, all right, calves are growing like other things. And then it just stopped. So then I started trying these other different experiments. And one was, and again, looking back, I was like, why would this be that great? But it was 100 reps per day for 30 days straight of body weight, basically like off a stair or something like that. So I'm like, this obviously sucks. Like, you're doing like 10 sets of 10 or what, whatever it is, to hit 100 reps. And after the 30 days, they had shrunk by a quarter of an inch. So that was great. and obviously, there's been many more experiments. So I'll go through a few like key ones. You're familiar with DC training, dog craft training with Dante Trudell. So he had a pretty torturous method for calves. So you would do a 5-second eccentric, a 15-second stretch, and then an explosive concentric. And then, do that for, I think it was 15 total reps. And that was hell. And I remember listening, like, I would be, this is whatever, like 17. I'm like listening to like Dragon Ball Z motivation, like as I'm like doing this, just like, it's like hell. But actually worse than that, probably the most miserable was also a DC, was like a secret DC, I don't know, it was a secret, but it was a less talked about DC method where he would have you go on a treadmill and you'd have the highest incline and you'd lean forward. And you would just do like 15 minutes of like highly contracted steps on this treadmill. And it, you'll do it for 30 seconds a minute. And you're like, this isn't that hard. Like obviously each isn't a failure, but that is a god awful 15 minutes. Like it's just very miserable. So that was probably the most miserable thing I had done for calves. My entire freshman year, I was on the-
Did either one of those work?
No, none of them worked.
Yeah. I think that we got to keep coming back to eat after each one
So I think, well, that's the conclusion for all of these is none of them works. My freshman year, I lived on the 9th floor and I maybe like twice took an elevator. I always took the stairs entire year. And I gained, like my freshman year, I gained like netted 7 pounds of lean body mass after I bulked up like 25 pounds, cut back down.
Yeah.
0.0 inches on the calves. So it's kind of amazing. And so, and then the most one I've talked about is the most, let's see, probably the last 2.5, maybe almost 3 years now, I've not done a single rep really, other than maybe like during my warmups, for my left calf. And they have been to the 16th of an inch exactly the same. So, and I would say on average, I'm doing about 12 sets of calves per week. I will say maybe
on just one calf though.
Just one calf. Correct.
So the other one's nothing.
Nothing. Wow. You know, obviously it's the smallest amount of stimulation from like leg curls, and I do like some sprints here and there, but no real calf
work. Squats?
I do squats. I don't do squats like I used to though, for other related, like other reasons, but I obviously think, again, there's some stimulus there, but I mentioned this with Jeff Alberts. It's like, well, if we're going to say that it's able to maintain everything just from squats or like some bike sprints, then like, what are we really doing? And like, if that's enough, then it's kind of, I think it's a little silly. So it's been interesting. And I think Brian Borstein recently did an experiment with his arms. And I don't know if this would apply with other things. Like, I've done a unilateral experiment with my thighs where I did all isolation exercises for my right thigh. And then my left thigh, I did the same isolations, but with added leg press. And it did make a difference. Within 6 months, there was a half an inch difference. So I'm definitely not trying to say like nothing matters. It's just, you know,
something total here. Nihilism yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Brian's still ongoing with his left arm only experiment, but he's actually seen growth in both arms since only doing so. Right. So there was one other thing I was going to mention with that. Oh, well, just that since this kind of new stretching method that I've kind of found on the stairs, there might be an like eighth of an inch difference, maybe. You know, I don't have one of those, what was it, ISAC or something qualified.
It's difficult to measure your own calf.
After hundreds, if not thousands of measurements, I'd like to think I'm reasonably consistent. So so we'll see. I totally would be down, though, to try this method that you're doing. Maybe you can send me a link to what you used. Just because
maybe you should wait till I get my calf thickness, like, because you might want to, like, if it doesn't work at all on me, you might be like, I don't want to use that device.
So just like a little history of all the craziness I've tried, because I know some people, you know, they come into any of our content, right? You come into the content where that person is now, and you might think this is what they've always done, or this, and it's not like if I'm doing six sets of calves and I'm saying, well, they're not growing, it's not because I've only ever done six sets of calves and I just do them standard and that's it. It's like, no, there's a decade long or more history here of trying things. And this is just kind of where I am currently. So just as a reference for people.
Yeah, same here. I've been training for, let's see, in June, it'll be 19 years. So that's
okay. I thought we started at the same time. I started in 2005, so you might have been just a little bit before me.
04.
Okay.
Yeah, I started in 04. I mean, it's I think there are definitely some muscles that are going to hit their functional limit to the point where, you know, maybe there's going to be, you know, a gram every couple of years that's just never going to be measurable, or you know. And I think also we can't something that I don't think most people outside of scientific circles are aware of is just how much there is in terms of variability within day to day. Like, if we were to do a calf measurement, even with an ISAC person, and you were to do a set of 10 calf raises, or even walk up three flights of stairs, you might have like a 0.5 centimeter difference, you know?
Sure.
So that can be the entire change that you might expect in a 6 week training period for someone who can grow calves, but is still trained, you know? So it's
also even during the time of day for calves specifically, Brian and I both noticed, and like hopefully this isn't like a cardiac edema issue, but you know, we have probably a half an inch of greater circumference on calves at night. So that's, you know, would make sense, you know, that whole gravity thing.
Absolutely. 100%. And like fluid shifts, differences in glycogen status, 100%, all that stuff can impact it. Like, I've looked at papers because I'm interested in the peaking process for bodybuilding on how does dehydration impact muscle size, and being dehydrated can substantially reduce muscle size kind of across the board. You know, muscle is, depending on the person, between 70-80% water, right? So I think all of these things introduce a non-negligible amount of error. And when you get to the point in your career where the change is less than the error, you have to look at these really long time periods to you know, really, really get anything. And you know, there will be a point whether your interest is physique or strength, where you hit your last PR. And that's just it. And I think for that reason, people need to have much more, and this is a totally off topic thing, but they need to have a deeper connection to why they lift than simply, I'm just trying to always be bigger, you know, so, or stronger.
Sure.
Or they won't stay in the game. So
yeah. Definitely. So when you had your recent AMA, I kind of joked and was like, I hope you're ready for an entire podcast on calves, but we actually did it. We made the entire
podcast.
So just to wrap up, you know, before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about all you have going on this year. And one of the things I think you have set yourself up with very nicely is you really have so many different, not only just like revenue streams, but just avenues of interest with this, right? You've got Iron Culture, you've got Mass, 3DMJ, you teach, right? You do research. I mean, you're really kind of all over the place, which is great. So if one thing starts to maybe trend down, you have something else. So what is going on in the world of Eric Helms 2023?
No, I appreciate that. And I think that's a very good perspective. I have a very, it's a localized portfolio in the world of lifting, but within that, it's a diversified happiness portfolio, as my good friend Alberto Nunez would say. And I think importantly, if we're talking about what do people get out of this, is, you know, there's always people entering this space, and being able to give back to the community, reach people who are newer, who could very easily go down paths that would be worse off for their life, trying to help them find the right source of information and better philosophies for why they're doing things, I think is an important service. And I have a lot of opportunities to do that. So yeah, I'm a research fellow at AET. So I get the opportunity to mentor PhDs and master students to be the next group of researchers carrying forward, hopefully always better research that is more connected to the community. Like you said, Iron Culture, my books, I'm working on the third edition of the Muscle and Strength Pyramids. Mass is continuing to evolve and grow, which I love. And this year I'm competing in bodybuilding. So I actually literally started my contest prep diet today, and I'll be competing in a series of WNBF shows, probably starting in September. So, like I said, I got to drop like 15 kilos before I'm in stage shape. So no rush. It's going to take me a bit. And I'm also doing what will hopefully become something akin to an Iron Culture documentary. We're going to get a lot of the filming done this year. So history, science, culture is our kind of three themes in Iron Culture. So we're going to be going to labs, interviewing students, historical sites, and you know, major competitions. So culture, science, history, and really just trying to give people a like an inside look into what is going on and what kind of meaning is there and what is going on culturally here, which I think is pretty cool. So anyway, I'm going to have a lot of fun with all of that. And that results in me basically traveling more months out of the year than not to a pretty significant degree.
Yeah. You competed in 2022 or 21?
2019. COVID time suck is what's blowing.
Wait, your comeback after 7 years was 2019?
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
It was actually 8 years. So I competed 07, 09, 2011, 2019, and now it'll be 2023.
That just my mind. That was going to be 4 years.
It might be because I compete in other stuff. So I did do Olympic weightlifting season in 2020, and then I did like a strongman comps in 2019 and 2020, and powerlifting. So I had like the year I did Highland Games, weightlifting, and powerlifting. And then I had a year, which was when the big lockdowns happened here, where I was making a full push towards powerlifting. So, yeah, I had some... I was still doing strength competitive aspirations over the last few years, which might feel like, you know, competing.
Wow, man.
No speedo.
Well, that was awesome. Thank you for taking the time. I thought this was great. I probably imagine that by the time we have this out, well, I don't know, when do you expect to have the actual result published?
Yeah, we'll have to write a paper and actually submit it. So like realistically, we're looking at mid this year that there's actually a paper people can read.
Ah, okay. All right. So
yeah, realistically, cool. That's just the kind of the speed of published science. But I would definitely encourage people to take a look at the papers by Warnke. They're all open access. Jump on Google Scholar and just type in, like, you know, gastric nemius, stretch, you know, Warnke, W-A-R-N-E-K-E. And there's a fair amount of studies that are out there that you can find, the most recent one in Frontiers, I think, is probably the most interesting, the sex differences one.
Yeah, yeah. Cool, man. All right. Well, 3DMJ.com or 3DMuscleJourney.com, right?
3DMuscleJourney.com, yes, sir.
And where else can people find you?
Yeah, so if you head to 3DMuscleJourney.com, that is the number 3, the letter D, MuscleJourney.com. You can find links to Mass, my books, the 3DMJ podcast, and also the Vault, where we have all our courses, both paid and free. And then Iron Culture on all podcast platforms. That's me and Omar and our various guests chopping it up. And then if you want to find out other podcasts I've done, like this wonderful one that I'm not hosting, but I'm a guest on, make sure to follow me on Instagram at Helms3DMJ.
Awesome. Thanks again, man.
Thank you.